listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. How in the space of a year did a community turn on itself, resulting in the murder of 20 people and imprisonment of more than 100 others for witchcraft? Included among those who were in an unheated prison in New England winter were church leaders and Boston elite, men and women, even a four-year-old girl. What was it like to live in a world in which witches and demons were part of everyday life? And at the same time, how did that time's commonality with our own, when it's easy, say, to have a bone to pick with your neighbor, play a role in this phenomenon? Delving into this period is not easy for a historian. Official trial records are largely missing. 1692 is actually missing from the diaries of those times. Pages are ripped out. Then it was all over. No more executions, convulsions, or demons in the sky at night. And for the next 300 years and more, people were left wondering, what happened? What happened in Salem? And now we have Stacy Schiff's new retelling, The Witches, Salem, 1692, to which she brings empathy, irony, a keen eye for humor and nuance. Schiff combines her storytelling skills with meticulous research and a historian's rigor, all of which were on display in her previous works, including Vera, Mrs. Vladimir Nabokov, which won the Pulitzer Prize, Cleopatra, A Life, a number one bestseller, and two others, a biography of Saint-Exupéry and a great improvisation, Franklin, France, and the Birth of America. With Stacy Schiff tonight is historian John Wiener, who many of you know from his excellent Drive Time radio program on KPFK 90.7 FM. John is a contributing editor to The Nation magazine and a professor of history emeritus at UC Irvine, where he specialized in recent American history. And his books include Historians in Trouble, Plagiarism, Fraud, and Politics in the Ivory Tower, Give Me Some Truth, the John Lennon FBI Files, and Professors, Politics, and Pop, and Come Together, John Lennon in His Time. Please welcome our guests, John Wiener and Stacy Schiff.
I loved your book.
Thanks, John. Can we open it to questions now?
So, 1692, Massachusetts Bay Colony executed 14 women, 5 men, and 2 dogs for witchcraft. I want to ask you to read a passage, one of my favorite passages from the beginning about who these people were. There were 150 people named as witches or wizards in 25 villages and towns, and it all centered in Salem.
So this is from the introduction. The youngest of the witches was 5, the eldest nearly 80. A daughter accused her mother, who in turn accused her mother, who accused a neighbor and a minister. A wife and daughter denounced their husband and father. Husbands implicated wives, nephews their aunts, son-in-laws their mothers-in-law, siblings each other. Only fathers and sons weathered the crisis unscathed. A woman who traveled to Salem to clear her name wound up shackled before the afternoon was out. In Andover, the community most severely affected, one of every 15 people was accused. The town's senior minister discovered he was related to no fewer than 20 witches. Ghosts escaped their graves to flit in and out of the courtroom, unnerving more than did the witches themselves. Through the episode surged several questions that touched the third rail of our fears. Who was conspiring against you? Might you be a witch and not know it? Can an innocent person be guilty? Could anyone, wondered a group of men late in the summer, think himself safe?
So what exactly was a witch? If you asked a 17th century New Englander, that question, what kind of answer would you have gotten?
A very specific answer, in that a witch was known to be in compact with the devil. So a witch was not Margaret Hamilton or Professor McGonagall. A witch was someone who had signed a diabolical pact and was engaged in malevolent activity. And really what her job was to recruit more people to be in league with the devil. And I should say his or her, because a witch could be a man or a woman, although it was more commonly a woman.
And you have this vivid, another one of my favorite passages is about what it was like for the witches who flew on broomsticks. They actually believed that witches flew on broomsticks.
I'm hesitating here because I want them to fly on broomsticks, and clearly so do you, but they don't.
Well, what are those sticks?
What do you call
those sticks?
This was a terrible problem with the first paragraph of the first chapter, because they fly on poles or sticks, but no one ever says brooms. And it's really annoying because we want them on broomsticks. And moreover, when they fly, which they claim to do, many people confess that they have flown through the air on poles or sticks. They never say they fly at night, which is also very irritating because we want them to fly at night. But in fact, it's broad daylight. Anyway, what was your question?
They sailed above the treetops.
They sail above the treetops, and we have this from confessions. At some point or another, 50 or so people will confess to having flown to a diabolical Sabbath, and they fly by various kinds of conveyance. But my favorite is the woman who flies from Andover on a pole with a neighbor. And she's very specific about the fact that before she takes off, she puts bread and cheese in her pocket as a snack. And the best part, of course, is that there's an aerial mishap and the pole crashes en route to the diabolical Sabbath. And so she knows this has really happened because her leg still hurts. And that's an incredible level of specificity when you're talking about a memory that presumably is a memory of something that never happened. Presumably.
So all this got started when two pre-adolescent girls started talking about people who they said were witches. And the big question for me is, why would anyone, especially a culture that believes children should be seen and not heard, why would they believe two pre-adolescent girls who were telling these wild stories? And actually, there's quite a good reason. Another of the accused witches confessed. But why would anyone confess? Tell us about the first confession and why you think she confessed.
The girls accuse three women. Or it's hard to say that the girls accuse. The girls seem to have suffered from some sort of spell. And three names are immediately trotted out. It's unclear whether the girls name the women or whether adults suggest those names to them. And the three names are of three very vulnerable women, in that one is very litigious, one is homeless and a beggar, and she's been on the nerves of everyone in the village, and the third is a slave, and that's the one who will, in court, confess to witchcraft, which rather sets things in motion, because once someone has actually legitimized, validated the fact that witchcraft is at work, then the authorities tend to disbelieve anyone who says that they are not practicing witchcraft. It should be pointed out that this is a slave. This is actually the slave of the minister in whose household the witchcraft breaks out, and it's Tituba, whom many of you will recognize from Arthur Miller, although she's not, in truth, the kind of character Miller makes her out to be. But she's a slave who's delivering to the most powerful men she's ever met a story that they are somewhat collaborating with her on. So it's difficult to say that this confession was entirely hers. It sounds to have been sort of co-authored by her along with the justices of the peace who are deposing her. And she tells a very convincing story of flying to Boston, and she mentions that there are actually 9 witches in all, some of them Bostonians, and she hints at the fact that there is a conspiracy, and that very much sets things in motion.
Now, witchcraft in this world was against the law. It was a criminal offense to make a pact with the devil.
You don't have that law in California?
And you have this wonderful list of the capital crimes in the first legal code in Massachusetts. What was on the list in order of the capital crimes?
It's terrible that I know that by heart, isn't it? The first is idolatry, and the second is witchcraft. And
after that, where's murder?
significantly below that.
Murder
but,
is...
but if it makes you feel any better, bestiality is on there. but witchcraft, I mean, we are talking about a Bible commonwealth here. And under a theocratic regime, witchcraft is understood to be a major, I mean, this is heresy. So it makes sense that it should register that high on the list. What sets Salem apart is that even though it is that high on the list of capital crimes, it has not been prosecuted all that often. There have been about 100 or 103 prior New England witchcraft cases. Massachusetts has only hanged six people. So what sets 1692 apart is not just the witchcraft, it's this unrelenting prosecution of it.
Prosecution. The fact that it's a criminal offense means witches stand trial. And this being New England, the home of American freedom, presumably the accused has a right to offer a defense. The accused can plead innocent. A jury of peers or somebody hears evidence and issues a verdict. Were any of the accused found not guilty?
Alas, no. It is 100% conviction rate.
100% conviction.
100% conviction rate. You touch on two things there. One person, Rebecca Nurse, whose name some of you will recognize, who's a 70-year-old farm woman, an unlikely person to have been accused, a full church member from a very functional, much-liked family in Salem Village, comes before the court, and the jury delivers a verdict of not guilty. The Chief Justice then sends the jury back to re-deliberate. they then issue a verdict of guilty, surprisingly enough. The family is the only family who will actually go to the governor to ask for a reprieve, which is granted, in fact. That somehow, we don't know how, is immediately overruled. So she is actually twice sort of reconvicted, and she will hang. So other than that, no, there is no moment where there's any doubt about anyone who walks into that courtroom. Part of that comes from the enormity of the symptoms of the girls. These girls are in such agony. They're convulsing, they're writhing in the courtroom, they're plucking pins out of their skin and out of their hair. The pins are illustrated in the book, actually. They're suffering terrible injuries and indignities. It does seem as if they are bewitched. So it's Exhibit A for the prosecution is right there in the courtroom. And they're seeing things in the courtroom, like canaries and bluebirds, which everyone else seems to believe are really there, even if they can't see them. It's a very strange kind of Emperor's New Clothes situation, a reverse Emperor's New Clothes, I guess. And also there's a problem in the courtroom in that when you say innocent until proven guilty, you have no right to counsel if you are the accused at this point. Hearsay is acceptable. Innocent until proven guilty isn't yet a concept. That's still years in the future. And there are no lawyers yet in Massachusetts. As a matter of fact, a few years earlier, a letter had gone to London saying, could you please send us a few honest lawyers if such a thing exists in nature?
But there was the possibility of a not guilty verdict, and there were skeptics in England, at least, in the 17th century, people who said, in fact, there was no such thing as witchcraft, and it's easy for us to see the logic of this. Witchcraft is so preposterous, so far-fetched, so improbable, yet there were no not guilty verdicts. People were not skeptical in New England. Why do you think there was no skepticism in this town, in this civilization?
New England at this point is living in a strange kind of time warp. These people are three generations at most removed from their English relatives. And actually, when I started the book, I kept thinking there would be a lot of correspondence back to family members in England about what was happening, which in fact there's very little of. But they're three generations removed from England, and they are somewhat separated. They're separated by a very wide ocean and a long time delay. And the ministers in New England have made it not possible. They've insulated the colony from any of those books that might have cast doubt, in fact, on the existence of witchcraft. So the news that England is not prosecuting witches anymore on the grounds which New England is about to do has not really penetrated the colony at this point. The very improbability of witchcraft, interestingly, was used to argue in its defense. This was so crazy, this was so preposterous, but all cultures seem to subscribe to this belief, ergo, it must be true. It's too, nobody could make this stuff up.
Nobody could make this stuff up.
Right.
But I keep saying but Harvard University committed to Veritas. Harvard College is going strong at this point, and Harvard sends some important people to bring wisdom to this world.
And the wisest of those was probably the Chief Justice of the Witchcraft Court, after whom a building at Harvard is today named, exactly. It was the foundation of the New England ministry that witchcraft was a fundamental fact of life. If you expressed skepticism, at least early in 1692, you were accused of witchcraft. So it was not a healthy time to express any doubts about the existence of sorcery. By the end of the summer, you finally, as the numbers begin to increase, the numbers of accusations begin to increase exponentially, you finally have people who begin to very quietly or without signing their names to them issue statements suggesting that perhaps this idea might be mistaken. Thomas Brattle is the first person who actually, he walks into the book, and I felt as I was working like this, the Enlightenment had just dawned. I mean, he's the person who says, you know, you can't see with your eyes closed. How can these girls be having visions? And begins to sort of poke holes in the prosecution and in the methods the court has been using to detect the witchcraft.
Thomas Brattle, our hero. And, of course, that's why there's a Brattle Theater in Cambridge right now. The first accusers are these adolescent girls. You have a revealing moment where one of the these adolescent girls is called a liar. I'm going to quote, "The teenager conceded that she had misspoken. She said she did it," I'm quoting you, "for sport. They must have some sport." Now, isn't that tremendously significant? Seems tremendously significant to me.
Seems sort of indicative of something to me, too. There's also a sort of throwaway line of Cotton Mather's when he's observing an earlier case of witchcraft, where he notices that when the children are closely observed, their symptoms tend to be more pronounced, and that when there's no one around to witness them, they tend to be a little bit quieter. So there are a number of those, or a child who was under a spell could scrub a clean table, but she couldn't scrub a dirty table. Or my favorite, which is the 1693 case, because witchcraft, and I should have said this, the belief in witchcraft will survive the trials, even after everyone has conceded that that there has been a miscarriage of justice and that they have unfairly prosecuted innocence. The idea that witchcraft exists is still in the air. But in 1693, Cotton Mather is observing a bewitched girl who will dismiss all the women at her bedside but ask the men if they could please stay. I always thought that was indicative of something.
And another one about these teenage girls. Sometimes, you write, sometimes they would be deaf, sometimes dumb, sometimes blind, and often all this at once. Cotton Mather wrote this. What does this sound like to you?
I think the rest of that sentence is a perfectly acceptable definition of adolescence at any time, isn't it? Only after I finished working on this book did it occur to me I had been living with an adolescent girl for 5 years. So, yeah.
Well, there was at least one skeptical person who testified. Martha Corey said, quote, "We must not believe all that these distracted children say," close quote. And she said, "I have nothing to do with witchcraft." What happened to Martha Corey?
That's not a happy story. Martha Corey is one of my favorites because she's the first unlikely person to be accused. She's the fourth victim, or fourth person accused. And she's a full church member. She's exceedingly, sort of annoyingly pious. I mean, even to her fellow church members, she's pious. And when she's named, no one can quite believe that she's named. So a church deacon and another man ride out to her farm to tell her, almost as a courtesy, that she's been accused. And she says a few things which surprise them, like she anticipates their question, which they seem to think means she has supernatural powers. It's pretty obvious what they were going to ask her. She says of her accuser, who's a 12-year-old girl, "Did she ask what clothes I had on?" Which, in fact, the girl had been asked that question. So again, she seems to have supernatural powers. And she vows that she's going to open the eyes of the ministers and the magistrates so they can figure out who the real witches who are around are. And of course, that implies that she's smarter than the magistrates and the ministers, which also will work against her. So ultimately, she will not fare well during her hearing. When you ask about the courtroom, a woman starts pelting her with her muff and her shoes, and Martha Corey will hang at the end of the summer.
She hangs.
After 6 months in prison.
6 months in prison.
I think that's 6 months, March to the, yeah.
And the slave who was the first to confess, what happened to her?
Oddly enough, Tituba, after offering this extraordinary, really colorful, vivid tale, doesn't seem ever again to have been consulted, although elements of her story will appear in other people's testimony. And she'll be the first to be imprisoned and the last to be released from prison. She'll spend 15 months in prison. And we lose track of her. She's her prison fees. You couldn't get out of prison unless your fees were paid. Someone pays her fees, not her master. And she seems to have left Massachusetts at that point. But we lose all track of her then. I should say that the oddity here is that if you confessed, you lived, and if you insisted, as did Martha Corey, on your innocence, you hanged, which is another reversal with Salem.
And then one day it ended. They stopped having trials. They stopped executing people. Did anybody have a sense that maybe they'd gone too far? Were there doubts? Were there regrets? Were there apologies? Did anybody say, never again?
Well, as you just heard, there's this terrific and terrifically frustrating hole in the record. The shock to the system must have been extraordinary when the court is shut down in the fall. Because when you think about it, girls who have accused their mothers, mothers who have hanged, go back to living with their families. Parishioners who've accused their ministers go back to listening to their ministers in meeting. Ministers who've accused parishioners go back to living alongside their parishioners. And the year disappears. The year evaporates. The sermons are missing. The diaries are missing. The letters are missing. A few years later, you begin to see rumblings of a need to come to terms with this. In New England, a calamity always registered as a verdict. And in the years after the trials, the economy is a little bit off, the weather gets very bad, and all of this is interpreted as a judgment from God that they have never really reconciled themselves to what had happened in 1692. And one of the witchcraft justices will finally, in 1706, before his minister, apologize for his role in the trials. And that's the first open, and only on the part of the court, only open acknowledgement of wrongdoing. Stoughton, our friend, will go to his grave without ever mentioning the trials or any regret about them. And in fact, will seem to look down on Samuel Sewall for that apology.
And there's another possibility. They prosecuted the wrong people.
That's what they seem to believe, actually, is that there had been witchcraft at work, but they got the wrong witches, and that the witches have gone, they've let the witches out, and they've prosecuted innocents, which is a stunning version of, when you think about it, of the history. One of the little girls will later apologize, and then pretty much a silence descends on the whole affair, insofar as New England can handle it, for many years.
So you say, we think Salem was a story of one thing, behind which was a story about something else altogether. I want to talk about what the something else might have been, which is something, of course, historians have been puzzling over for decades. The first possibility is, of course, this has something to do with what we now call girl power. These are adolescent, rebellious girls who have found a way to play a central role in their societies, which they'd otherwise been denied, or women in general, that this was a case of female power. The witches are women who have incredible powers to make animals fall down sick. And what do you think of this theory, that this is girl power or woman power?
There are a number of agendas at work here, as I talk about in the book, and they lock together with a sort of click in a way. And the girls clearly have an agenda of their own. I'm not sure they know what their agenda is. And in fact, the girls are the hardest piece here, I think, to analyze, because we have no diary from any of the girls. And what we do know of their voices, we're getting from those who took down their testimony in court, which, of course, are their elders and their fathers and other men in the community. The only place we get to hear really from the girls themselves is when they talk about how they talk to the devil. And they make bargains with the devil and what the devil wants from them when he comes to attack them. And there you see you begin to see the strains on the girls and the longings of the girls. And it's interesting that I promised I would work for recruit me, the devil promised me, you know, ease from labor, help with the housework, you know, travel, silks. I mean, it sounds like what we all want, basically, right? But you get a sense there of what's missing from their lives and what's causing them pain to some extent. So I'm not sure that they set out in need of sport to create a witchcraft epidemic. And nor am I sure that, and can we ever be sure of what those first two little girls who were living in a particularly fraught household for various reasons could possibly have been experiencing at that moment, or if what affected them was what affected the other girls later. And also I should say, there are five men who hang. There is a diabolical conspiracy at work, but at the head of it is not a woman, it's a man. It's a minister. It's a Harvard-educated minister who's said to be the diabolical mastermind behind this whole plot to upend the government of Massachusetts.
So you look seriously at the symptoms that the girls exhibit that are called witchcraft, and you notice that 200 years later, psychiatrists, neurologists see very similar symptoms and write about it.
Well, if you look at the pictures of what, we have no images of these girls, there are some very clinical accounts of what they're suffering, and it's pretzel limbs, their backs arch up, their tongues circle in their mouths, their faces go into grimaces, they're in trances much of the time. And if you look at what 19th century physicians were diagnosing then as hysteria and drawing pictures of in French institutions, for example, the symptoms correspond exactly. These had been the same symptoms that the bewitched girls in 1688, I should add, had suffered. And those cases were probably known to the girls in 1692. Thanks to Cotton Mather, who'd written about them. So these were recognized to be the symptoms of witchcraft. And even Rebecca Nurse will say at one point she didn't go to visit the girls, although she lives not far away. And she knows she should have, she says, but she had these kinds of symptoms when she was younger and she was afraid she might get them again. So clearly these are not unfamiliar. Many people will mention fits in their diaries. So it's not a completely unfamiliar set of symptoms.
So what we find in, let us say the word, Freud, hysteria, the conversion of unacceptable emotions into physical symptoms. Very efficient definition.
Well, they're clearly trying to say something they can't enunciate. So that does seem to be playing a certain role here.
So maybe we should talk about sex. Puritanism for us means sexual repression. Maybe it was all about sex.
You know, I have to tell you, if you read the court records leading up to 1692, there was no sexual repression. These people are very active. there's an immense amount of fornication going on in New England. Who knew? If you read those records,
You have.
I have with such delight, I have to tell you. Other people's misadventures and foibles are so delightful. The number of cases of girls assaulted by lascivious swine herders or masters in the houses in which they live, they're actually horrifying, these stories, or other servants in the houses in which they live. A lot of these girls are not living with their biological families. Many of them are war refugees, and very often they're working as servants. And they are clearly physically vulnerable to an enormous, girls are assaulted in barns, girls are assaulted in fields. We can't connect any of those cases with the suffering girls in 1692. The language is remarkably sexual. I mean, they talk about being poked and prodded and pinched and lots of pitchforks and things. But there's no evidence that links this in any way directly to sexual assault.
And I'm also very interested in where the story of Salem fits into American history. New England was supposed to be the shining city on the hill. It's the cradle of democracy. It's the place that gave us our independence. But you have these wonderful phrases. This was America's tiny reign of terror. I love that. And you call it a crack up on the way to the Constitution. Where do you fit this into American history?
I think what shocks us is that we think of witch trials as something that happened in medieval Europe. It doesn't happen in enlightened, idyllic Massachusetts. Also, I think we forget that these men are not Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson. We forget that these are fundamentalist. This is a fundamentalist theocracy, and these people are utterly. They are taking the Bible at its word, and they really have no use for anything that doesn't fit into this particularly closed system. And I think that's one of the reasons we keep going back to this, because we can't get over the fact that this Puritan DNA, it's a very serious strand in our national makeup, but it isn't something we necessarily want to connect with all the time.
Of course, it was Arthur Miller who found the foreshadowing of McCarthyism in the Salem story. The Crucible took the idea of the witch hunt and said that's what we had when people were called on to name names and to confess, and refusal to confess was evidence of guilt. That does sound sort of like what you found in Salem.
The only difference being that there were some communists, but there were no, presumably, witches, right? And I should say that when Arthur Miller went back to research the Crucible, he discovered still, this is 1952, I think, that he researches it, that no one in Salem was willing to discuss the witch trials even then. He says nobody will
really?
Talk about it. Yes, absolute silence.
So I looked up the Crucible a little bit. The Broadway revival had Liam Neeson and Laura Linney as John and Elizabeth Proctor. There was one TV production that starred George C. Scott and Tuesday Weld. The 1996 movie had Daniel Day-Lewis and Winona Ryder. Did you see that
one? I did see that.
What did you think?
It's a little wide of the mark historically, but there's a lot of sort of, you know, dancing in the woods. Tituba in Arthur Miller's version is the sort of voodoo practicing stock character. She's become African American by now. She starts out Indian, but she's become African American by Arthur Miller's rendering. And Miller takes a lot of liberties with the history, like injecting a sexual component in it that wasn't a relationship in it that wasn't there, which means he neatly has to change the age of a girl from 11 to 18 so that he can have this affair take place. So that's the Winona Ryder role.
In the Rosenberg Adam Spy case, the judge sentencing the Rosenbergs to death, this was 1951, said they were part of a, quote, diabolical conspiracy to destroy a God-fearing nation, close quote. I'd say that has some echoes of Salem.
It's like the language was just lifted directly from Cotton Mather, isn't it?
And would you say there was a kind of a witch hunt that followed 9/11, the jailing of young Muslim men without evidence that they'd committed?
Any time that you take a group of people and you say that they've done something that, or that they are something that they don't believe they are, you're engaging in the same kind of behavior that these justices were engaging in when they try to convince someone that she was a witch when she's indicating that she wasn't a witch. I mean, that need for moral purity, I think, is something we particularly feel when we're under attack. We feel we need to look for the traitors or the terrorists or the secret agents. And that's precisely what was happening in 1692 for very different political reasons, but you have a country that's you have a colony that's very dislocated, has had no government. It's feeling very much under attack by Indians, so, you know, swarthy men in the backyard. And there's this feeling that menace is in the air, and we need somehow to establish order and to prove that we know how to establish order. So there are all kinds of things contributing to that feeling.
And to go back to 1692, there was a kind of a preliminary question. Why was all this happening in Salem? Why did Satan have a grudge against Salem?
Because it's so alliterative. Cotton Mather's version, take on this, and I do look to Cotton Mather a lot because he so beautifully defines everything that happens and can't stop writing about it, which is, of course, why he gets blamed for it.
How many books did Cotton Mather write?
370-something.
370-something.
I haven't read them all.
How many books have you written?
300 and... No. how many books has Joyce Carol Oates written?
You're right. But we digress.
What was I about to say? Cotton Mather. I had something to say there. Oh, Cotton Mather's
was
feeling...
was explaining Salem.
In that he felt it was a badge of honor, in fact, that this diabolical assault had occurred where it occurred. because it was proof that Massachusetts consisted of the chosen people. And why, you know, the devil will only appear there where he is hated most. So this was in fact something he welcomed to some extent. Then there's great evangelical mileage to be wrung from this, because it's further proof, first of all, that Massachusetts is exceptional in some way. We can relate to this feeling, right? American exceptionalism is at work here. But also it's an indication that the second coming is not far off. And the Boston ministry has for years engaged in some very specific calculations as to when the second coming will be happening. So here finally is proof that it's imminent.
And how imminent was it?
I think in 1692, the year chosen was 1697. There's always a very specific year when it's going to happen.
Before we open to questions, I just want to ask you a little bit about the work of writing it. There have been, you know, hundreds of books by historians, and what was your favorite book that you read in all your reading about Salem?
I would say that David Hall's work was probably most helpful, in that it's largely about, I mean, it's so much about every aspect of Congregationalism, but he so beautifully delineates the superstition and the religion and how the two play together. And how high culture and low culture have somehow conjoined at this point. And he very much gets into the interior life of these people, which is what I was trying to do as well. Because really the only way to explain this, it seemed to me, was to get into their minds and explain, really examine their fears and their preoccupations and the stresses on them, because then you can really understand how they could do this, how they could believe this, and how these events could actually take place.
Now, one of the most striking things about this book is the cast of characters that you print at the beginning. It's about 5 pages long. I'm a tremendous fan of your previous book, the Pulitzer Prize-winning literary biography, Vera. There you only had to write about one person, one husband, one set of letters, one set of novels. Here you have hundreds of people. That must have been hard.
It's worse because they all seem to have the same name. and that in part is why there is this cast of characters, in that the Puritans were not very original in naming their children. They tend to name several children after themselves. So you have Mary Lacy Sr. and Mary Lacy Jr., who accuse each other of witchcraft in court, mother and daughter. But everyone seems to have the same 5 or 6 names. And my feeling on a cast of characters is always that, to me as a reader, that signals, oh no, hard work ahead. You know, it's Tolstoy, here we go. But that for most of us, we would just ignore that, and the few people who wanted it. Actually, people have told me they've loved the cast of characters, because it does flesh out to some extent, if you go back to it, whom you're reading about. There are an awful lot of people accused, and I didn't want to write about everyone, I couldn't have written about everyone, but so many people contribute to this sort of demented game of telephone, and you can't really show how this crisis develops without them.
So I have to ask about the mother and daughter who accused each other.
It's actually 3 generations. It's a mother, daughter, and grandmother. And it begins with the 17-year-old who, it's actually an extraordinary scene. The 17-year-old accuses both her mother and her grandmother in court. And because at this point in the summer, this is July or August, a confession will help you not to hang. Or because the women are simply trying to please the authorities, both the mother and the grandmother will confess. And it's, in fact, that the grandmother is, to go back to where we started, the woman who crashes on the, not broom, but stick, on her way to the diabolical Sabbath.
So a 17-year-old girl calls her mother a witch, and the judges believe it. I mean, today, this we'd have a different...
You know, there were a lot of, there's a fairy tale aspect to this whole story, and there are a lot of evil stepmothers. Women died often in childbirth, the result of which was there are a lot of stepmothers. And the first girl who will actually, after Tituba, who will break open the whole story, is a girl who's clearly trying to get revenge on her evil stepmother, for whom she has been the bane of her existence already for several years.
Obvious to you, but how did the judges react?
They thought that what this girl was saying was utterly true, and actually she's the first person who points a finger to the poor minister who will hang.
One more thing that we need to talk about. Husbands accused their wives of being witches.
That comes as a total surprise to you, right?
could wives accuse their husbands of being wizards?
I will say that that rarely happens.
Rarely happens.
But the idea of, for example, Martha Corey, when Martha Corey is accused, her husband will instantly say, I always thought she was a witch. And odd things have been happening, and the ox jumped 6 feet in the air, and the cat's been sick, and she's acting strangely. And oddly enough, he will go on to become a very sympathetic character, but he doesn't start out so well, and he is not a New England first in accusing his wife.
Well, thank you very much, Stacy Schiff, for this amazing story. Yeah, I just have to say, when you finish this book, you think, yeah, it all sort of makes sense. I can see the rationale for all of this, but weren't they all just totally crazy?
They sound as if they are on an acid trip sometimes, right? No, I thought it actually makes... I thought if you pry the whole thing apart and then you put it back together, and again, you do see how this could happen. What you do hope is that it could never happen again.
Yes. All right, let's open it for questions.
Thank you.
And... you know the rules. We have our assistants with microphones, and you will raise your hands, and please don't speak until the microphone is presented to you, because your words are being recorded for podcast and for posterity. And you know the rules about questions and not speeches. And one question, thank you.
If confessing would get you out of jail and stop you from being hung, why weren't there more confessions?
I may have misspoken. It will keep you from being hanged. It will not get you out of jail. So you went back to jail. And none of the confessors who go back to prison seem to know what's in store for them. Most of them seem to think they will eventually hang. But it is clear that they will not hang immediately, that the confessors are spared, partly so that they can inform on other people. So the confessors are just held, and by early summer, the jails are bulging with confessed witches, with people who have said that they are part of this diabolical conspiracy. Remember that confession is part of the whole Puritan narrative, that confession comes fairly easily to a Puritan. Everyone, if pushed, has a stain on his or her conscience. And it's interesting when these people start confessing, there isn't really a line between guilt and diabolical collusion. So when pressed and told that you are in some way, you have in some way engaged with the devil, what will come out isn't necessarily witchcraft. It's a bout of drinking or a case of adultery, or there's a woman who thinks she killed her child because the child fell down a well. We all have something. A, we all have something on everyone else, and B, we all have something that's sitting on our chest, and that tended to be what came out. So especially with women, it was never didn't seem to be difficult for the court to exact a confession.
Who else? Who's next?
I read once that there was a theory that some of these witches, these women who were having these hallucinations, might have actually been hallucinating because they had some flower that had been poisoned, ergot poisoning. Have you heard of this theory? And
this is the theory that just won't die. Yes. it was a wonderful theory. I think it was 1976. That there was ergot, that a fungus had grown in the rye supply. And that this fungus would, if you had then ingested any of this rye that had fermented, you apparently will hallucinate. And it's a lovely theory for many, many reasons. A, it clears up all the spectral stories here. B, what it does is it absolves everyone of guilt, of course, right? It was disproved fairly quickly for the following couple of reasons. Only some people are affected by it, when in theory everyone in Massachusetts would have been hallucinating. And for example, in the parsonage where you have these two little girls, there are several other children who are unaffected. Also, the kids do not always exhibit, I mean, as we said, their afflictions were sometimes more severe than at other times. And obviously, if you had this particular illness, it shouldn't have waxed and waned the way it did. And I should also add that it also apparently was the wrong time of year for the rye to have had this problem. The stories that they are delivering are not sort of free associative hallucinations. These are stories that completely follow from the tales they have been hearing about what the devil was up to, and they hew completely to the sort of Puritan playbook of diabolical doings. That doesn't sound to me like something that could have been caused by rye poisoning. It sounds like it could have been caused by poisoning from the pulpit, perhaps, but...
What happened to those who had confessed after the trial was finished, or the court was shut down, and I assume they were let out of jail?
They're let out of jail. The first people go home free in October, and it's generally children who go home free initially. And the jails are emptied completely by early 1693. There's a bit of a tug of war between the newly installed governor and the Chief Justice Stoughton about whether the trials are really over and whether the witchcraft court will ever sit again. The governor is a little bit less pious. He's a little bit less committed to this. Stoughton is absolutely hell and brimstone set on this, continuing this prosecution. So the jails empty slowly at first because there seems to be some hesitation between the two men. Once it is decided that the court will not meet again, the jails are emptied, people go home, their prison fees have to be paid. Later there'll be some restitution for most of those prison fees. And then we know nothing of how those confessed witches go back to living among people whom they have accused. I mean, that's the extraordinary part. What will happen, and again, we don't know the reason for this, is that over the next few years, families who have been victimized, whether they're confessors or whether they're people who've lost family members, will tend to intermarry. And it's unclear whether they did so because they had suffered a similar trauma or whether they do that because no one else will go near them because people still believe there's some taint attached to these supposed witches.
Over here.
When you were doing your research or in the book, is there more of a story with Mary Esty or Mary Esty? She's one of the town sisters, Rebecca's. She was one of the last accused witches hung. And did you learn more? Because the only thing I've ever read was her last will and testament, but I didn't know what came up to that. I'm a descendant of her, so I was curious.
You have a lovely family. I've been meeting them all week, all across the country. And a really big family, I might add. Mary Esty writes the most spectacular petition. I'm sure you've seen it from court, and it's one of the things that may have actually slowed the trials down. She's a sister of Rebecca Nurse. There are three sisters. She's much younger. And she and her and the third sister, Sarah Cloyce, will write a petition where they essentially ask the judges to please advocate for them fairly, because the judges are essentially serving as your defense counsel, there being no defense counsel at the time. And they basically cast some doubt as to how the court is proceeding and ask for rights that should, in fact, have been accorded to them as suspects. And it's an incredibly compelling petition. She must have had some kind of legal help with it. It doesn't sound like she could have written it alone. It doesn't do her any good, alas, but it is one of the things that is often cited as a possible a break on the system at this point.
Could you help us with an idea of the scope? You mentioned how many people were executed and how many accused, but in the population, would everyone have known someone? How big a town was it that all these people were accused from?
That's a great question. It's somewhere between 140 and 180 people who were accused. And it depends. It's 24 communities in all from which people, in which there are alleged witches living. Which is particularly fascinating given the fact that the girls didn't know most of the people whom they're accusing. They're pulling out names, and we don't know how or why, from several communities away often. The most severely affected community is Andover, which is just next to Salem. And in Andover, it would have been 1 in 10 people who's accused of witchcraft, and along family lines. Salem Village itself at this point is about 550 people. But again, there are fewer people accused there than there would be in Andover. It runs through Andover like a fever by the time it hits Andover.
I just like to follow up with one point. I always thought of Salem must be some isolated backwater, but actually Salem is quite an important place in New England at this time.
To go back a half step, Salem Town is a very important place in New England. Yes. It's the second to Boston in terms of really refined seaports. Salem Village, which is where the witchcraft will break out, is 5 miles down the road. It's a tiny, almost frontier village, made up of farmers who have left Salem town because they wanted better farmland. And there's a tension between the town and the village, which will play a certain role here. The court sits in Salem town. Salem village has no authorities, no autonomy of its own.
Thank you for this enlightening discussion. What did the church, how did the church survive this credibility crunch after the trials? Did people become agnostic? No, what was the outcome?
The church suffers a serious lapse of confidence after this, to some extent. A new charter had arrived in Massachusetts earlier in the year, in May of 1692, and under that charter, political toleration had been called for. The trials make it impossible not to. The trials make it all that much easier for that to happen because, of course, the ministry has compromised itself by its involvement in the witchcraft. The real hit comes to the whole idea of confession, which is so much at the heart of Puritanism. And confession by now has become tainted because of so many false confessions in the course of the witchcraft. It's much easier to criticize the authorities. The experts are no longer expert. And you get people speaking out against the government and the church in a way they could never have done before 1692. So it very much opens the door to a little fresh air.
And one more thing I'd like to inject at this point. We talk about the church, but there are also Baptists and there are Quakers in the colony. What happens to them in all this?
There are about six of each, as far as I can tell. The Quakers have been badly persecuted, obviously, by the Puritans. And one of the few comments that you do get about what's happening among those crazy Puritans is from the Quakers, who are basically looking at this and saying, you know, there they were hanging us, now they're hanging each other. And they're kind of merrily enjoying this, watching this thing go off the rails. There's a wonderful Salem shopkeeper named, to speak to your point, named Thomas Maul, who afterwards will write and publish a book outside of the province, very critical of the Massachusetts administration, something one could never have done before 1692. And he will be called into court for this, of course, because it's heretical to do this, and the books will be confiscated and burned. They do this in Massachusetts, you know. And in court, he will essentially say to the jurors, you don't want to have on your hands the kind of blood that the 1692 jurors had on their hands. And he will mock the system. He'll even mock the kind of evidence that had been used in 1692. So it's quite a delight to those outsiders when this happens.
Hi, I'm not related to anybody from, like, the woman over there. I did, my elementary school was called Cotton Mather School, however. So it's provoked somewhat of a lifelong interest. What do you make of some of the economic analyses of these alongside the sort of church Puritan thing? You know, Putnam being a landholder, as you mentioned earlier, you know, some of the girls being essentially servants in the household, a slave, a homeless person, Giles Corey being a very, if not litigious, at least combative person around land boundaries, et cetera. How do you, and what you mentioned about the town and city, the town and gown almost of Salem Village and Salem City. What do you make of that kind of interlaced through all the other beliefs and the issues of, you know, kind of moral turpitude, et cetera?
There's almost always a reason. I mean, you can't, with a few exceptions, you can almost always figure out a reason why someone was accused. I mean, George Burroughs, the minister, is possibly the exception there, although he's a very difficult and very contrary and perverse man who abuses wives, so there were some reasons there. Certainly with the Estee family, with the town sisters, there had been a decades-old land problem. And that seems to have been the reason why the girls were accused, why the sisters were accused. But their mother had also been accused of witchcraft. And in many cases, people are related to people who had been accused prior or had themselves been accused prior to 1692. The economic thing is hard. It's hard to say this is one demographic against another because it runs the gamut. You have a very, very rich Philip English, the richest merchant in Salem town, who's accused. Now, Philip English was a little too rich for everyone else's taste, was an extremely litigious man, and he'd sued everyone in sight. And he had claims on a lot, he had his eye on a lot of people's land. So those were very good reasons to accuse him of witchcraft. But you also get people who have abused the charity of the community, like Sarah Good, who, because they're impoverished, are accused. So it kind of cuts both ways, in fact. The only person who seems to make out well here economically is there's a very enterprising sheriff in this story, and he will tend to confiscate people's property as soon as they are sent off to jail. But he seems to have been working alone. I mean, I would say he was the only person who had economic incentive here. And he doesn't. There's no great conspiracy. He's just a particularly venal character, whom I'm happy to say dies young.
This is a question more perhaps for the audience than for you. I understand Rebecca Town Nurse has an enormous progeny, tens of thousands and so forth. How many in the audience are related either to her or to others in the among the accused or among the hung? I, for one.
Do we have any other witchcraft? Three. Four, we have one over here.
I was always told that was why I was good with computers.
So do you
I want to know how many people were in the crucible when they were in high school. And just see if that's more.
Two more questions.
Hi. We tend to think of Salem from the perspective of a modern society, and we can't quite fathom how anything so weirdly aberrant would happen. And yet, in the 1980s, if I remember correctly, we had the McMartin preschool thing that was not all that much different. I wonder if you could comment on that.
I can't think of a better parallel, a closer parallel than the one you bring up. This was the 1980s preschool scandals, which were not only in California, they were elsewhere as well. And it's a more perfect parallel even than McCarthyism, I think, in that there does not seem to have been any sexual abuse whatsoever, and you have children testifying to heinous acts, which seem to have been, I mean, I don't know where they came from, but again, you have this mass, you have this hysterical embrace of a kind of abuse that is almost inconceivable to us. I don't think that's a sole instance. I mean, I think that's a perfect parallel. I think you see traces of it elsewhere. Today, the book, I just got word that the book is on the bestseller list, and the book below it is Michael Savage's book about how Obama and Islamists are together, the dark forces combining to subvert our government and subject it to despotism. And I thought, that's the same book I just wrote.
Last question.
Oh, okay.
Thank you so much for your all your information and your research. I was wondering, as a fellow researcher of witch trials, and I wrote a novel on the witch trials as well. But I was wondering if in the process of all your investigation, you found any evidence to the different theories about the fact that a lot of the accused were women, but not just women, but women who were somehow on the outs with society. They were either, like Sarah Good, beggars living off of the their neighbors, and at the same time, like spitting at them for not giving her more, or they were widows with a lot of land. Who had a history of not getting along well with their neighbors, as well as slaves and women of color, and that there was some sort of, like, because the fear of the Indian was so strong, you know, was it true, in fact, that there was this moment of the paranoia and the hysteria of being taken over by others who were arriving in Boston and in New England in general?
The only person of color who's accused is Tituba, interestingly. The you can see it with some people that they are sharp-tongued or sharp-elbowed. I'm thinking of Susanna Martin, who's a very feisty 70-year-old widow who is extremely defiant and even sarcastic in court. There are certainly women who've been litigious who are called in. But you also have as many reasons to accuse as you would have had in any other social meltdown: envy, guilt, unrequited love. There's a woman who's clearly accused because someone had an affair go awry years earlier. Often you have decades-old grudges against the husband, which are then somehow settled by accusing the wife. And no midwives or any of the sort of typical people who are said to be witches. So I'd say that you can pretty much reason out, you can pretty much assign a reason to each one, but they are not always the typical, it's not always the outsider. And in many cases, like Rebecca Nurse, it's a startling question as to why this particular person is accused.
Stacy Schiff will be signing books in the lobby starting in 5 minutes. I want to thank you, Stacy Schiff, for The Witches.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks to everyone who came, and thanks to the library for sponsoring.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.